Hello and welcome back to Double Take, the podcast from Newton Investment Management that delves into the investment implications of big changes in technology, regulation, and society at large. I'm Rafe Lewis, head of Newton's specialist research teams. And with me, as always, is Newton investigative researcher Jack Encarnacio. And before we even go an inch further, I just want to say, if you like what you're hearing, if you're interested in the topics, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you find podcasts. Maybe leave a nice review. Tell your mother about us. So on this episode, we're going to be navigating the growing thicket that is antitrust regulation, not just in the United States, not just in the UK, not just in the EU, but the West we're talking about here. Things feel like they've gotten tougher, but we don't want to just go on our gut here. We want to talk to some folks who really know what they're talking about. We're in a moment here, just for a little context, where the U.S. Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice here in the United States, agencies like the Competition and Markets Authority in the U.K., the European Commission's Directorate General for Competition, they do seem particularly geared toward challenging the headline-grabbing mergers and buyouts, such as the blockbuster Microsoft-Activision tie-up.
Right, and deals like that have been in the crosshairs of different rulings and philosophies that we're seeing on how to best preserve competition and protect consumers from excessive price hikes. And while it's clear that regulators are applying close scrutiny to deals, is it actually harder to get a merger or acquisition through regulatory channels, or has the playbook to get that done just changed?
Yeah, so joining us to plumb the depths of this topic is Ronnie Habash of Deckert LLP, which is a global law firm particularly deep in the antitrust realm. And they published something that is called the Deckert Antitrust Merger Investigation Timing Tracker, which is more colloquially known as DAMIT. And that's a quarterly report that tracks the most significant M&A investigations, both in the US and the EU. So Ronnie has helped guide industry-leading companies to successful strategic transactions in the face of intense antitrust scrutiny by the U.S. Department of Justice, the FTC, Senate and House Judiciary Committees, State Attorneys General, international competition authorities. This is a person who knows whereof we speak today. And Ronnie, welcome to Double Take.
Good to be with you both. Thanks for having me.
That's great to have you, Ronnie. I figured we'd start the conversation with the U.S. focus and then maybe branch out. So to set the table, did the changeover in the American administration to the Biden administration and, you know, who he's appointed to various agencies and courts have any bearing on the picture we're talking about today, the antitrust picture? Did that mark a real or perceived change in antitrust attitudes?
You know, it's been interesting. So we do look at the data and damn it, and what the data is telling us is that even though there are a lot more headlines about the agencies becoming more aggressive, what we're actually seeing is that the total number of what we call significant investigations is actually down. But what we are seeing is that there is a change in the outcomes of those significant investigations. So where in the past we may have seen a large number of consent orders coming out of these merger investigations, now we're seeing far fewer consent orders, and we're seeing more complaints being filed to actually block these deals. So it's interesting in that the total number of enforcement actions is actually down significantly. I think it's at the lowest point it's been in the last decade or so. But what we are seeing is more complaints, and those, as you mentioned, those tend to be, at least in the recent couple of years, have been against mergers that are sort of your largest, highest profile deals. Whereas in the past, we might have seen a bigger mix of large and small and, you know, well-known companies and lesser known companies.
And quickly, Ron,
just to contextualize for our listeners, by the way, a consent order is when a company may take some action that allows the deal to go through, like divesting a certain business or a product, that kind of thing, right?
That's exactly right. So you could think of it as a settlement with the agencies before they decide to go to court. They may reach an agreement with the companies to divest a certain business or, you know, implement firewalls, things like that, that would resolve the competitive concerns from the agency's perspective and not lead to a court battle over the nature of the transaction.
So I guess the obvious question from all this is, I mean, so the number of these significant investigations is down, right? The consent decree stuff is down, but is the total number of deals that might get submitted to the U.S. government also down? Like, are companies kind of not pursuing the deals that they might have otherwise in previous eras?
Yeah, so it's a good question because in 2021, we saw record levels of M&A activity. And from that, you would expect that the number of enforcement actions really in sort of late 21 or even into 2022, because these investigations can take about 11 months to reach a conclusion. So you would expect, just based on the deal activity, that 2022 would have been a record year in terms of the number of enforcement actions by the agencies. But what we saw instead was that there were 20 significant investigations concluded by the agencies. And those are ones ending in a complaint or a consent order or abandonment of the transaction. And that was literally the lowest number over the past decade of data that we've been tracking these enforcement actions.
So how do you interpret that, Ronnie? Perhaps you're hearing from clients, you know, we're not as gung-ho as we would have been 3 years ago about pursuing M&A, or perhaps the temperature's just the same and the numbers are just what the numbers are.
Yeah, so what we are seeing is that there are some different or newer theories that are being brought to court. And so you're seeing different types of cases come through, I'd say. But traditionally, you would see a lot more of just the pure horizontal cases, you know, two competitors merging that compete head to head, and the agencies would sue to block those types of deals. Now, we tend to be seeing fewer of those, and we have started to see more in the vertical merger space and potentially some conglomerate type theories as well. And so I'd say the nature of the actions is changing. And it's hard to get a good read on exactly why the number is down. I will say that, you know, the ones that they have been bringing tend to be the higher profile deals. And so it may be that whereas in the past they used to go after deals of all sizes, we may be starting to see a focus on some of these larger ones that are just a little bit splashier and potentially could have a larger impact in the world if they are better known names.
You know, Jack and I are both emigres from the media. So what I'm about to say, I say with love as a former newspaper reporter, but the media narrative would suggest that the FTC and the DOJ are in a new, unparalleled level of aggression toward M&A activity, and that they're kind of going after them all, even if they think they're going to lose, just to make the point that they need more regulatory power. But it sounds like you're saying that is not the reality on the ground, in fact.
That's right. I think deal activity has slowed down, I think, for other macro type reasons, but and you might have a few deals that otherwise would have come through that maybe people were more hesitant just given the new theories that are being pursued. But overall, I mean, what we're seeing, you know, I tend to look at the numbers rather than my own instincts or what the media headlines are telling me. I think the data is hard to argue with, that the total number of significant investigations was actually at its lowest point in 2022.
And when we talk about new theories, Ronnie, and correct me if I'm wrong, what you're saying is the grounds that DOJ, FTC are citing to block a deal or to contest a deal in court are changing. Can you give us maybe a rough outline of what sort of the typical argument companies used to come up against before this current regime was to stop their deals, and how the pitch, I don't know, that's not a precise word, not a legal term, but you get what I mean, the grounds that are cited have changed in recent times.
Yeah, so a couple of examples that come to mind. I think we've seen some lawsuits against companies for potential competition or even potential competition that may not have been brought in the past. And we've seen a couple of cases dealing with vertical merger type theories. Those had started to pick up, I'd say, in prior administrations. And so not necessarily a change, but it is becoming a growing part of the types of deals that the agencies are going after.
Okay, can you talk
And
about
then,
potential competition for us, just to pause on that quickly? Meaning what? That the government is seeking to say that this will impinge a competitive environment that doesn't exist yet?
that's right. So the idea behind potential competition is that today there may not be a competitive concern to be worried about, but when you look at the sort of pipeline of products or technologies that are in the works someday down the road, and it's a key issue of how far down the road, those smaller companies that are being bought by potentially a larger company may be able to potentially grow in the future to become, disruptive and innovative. And the theory would be that by selling to these companies today, that there is some future competition down the road being lost. And, it's a very speculative theory. And I think that's why, at least in one case, we did see the FTC lose fairly handily on that theory.
Yeah, that one feels a little tougher to bring home, probably. When as we're talking about narratives here a little bit, and we investors hear quite often that big tech, in particular, has kind of a target on its back, that they may get a disproportionate share of attention from antitrust regulators. Is there anything to be said about what's happening with tech M&A versus, the other sectors of the economy?
So in the tech space, I think when we look at the numbers, we actually don't see that it's a large percentage of these enforcement actions that we're tracking in Dammit. It actually tends to be very small, and it's been very small for a number of years. So, the tech companies have done a lot of transactions over the past past multiple decades, but
Right.
Relatively, when we look at the number of enforcement actions from the agencies, it's actually a very small number of those enforcement actions have been against large tech companies. So, what do you read into that? It's hard to say, but so far we haven't seen some whirlwind of change here.
So we talked about consent orders earlier, Ronnie, and that being the idea that, a company that wants to avoid a lawsuit by the government blocking their merger can propose a series of fixes before it ever gets to court, where the agency can agree that, yeah, that will ameliorate or at least address the concerns we have about harming the state of competition in your industry. And so the merger can go forward. No one has to sue anybody. We can sort of resolve it at this level. You're indicating, and we're seeing that form of remedy has been falling out of favor recently, and that agencies like the FTC and the DOJ are much more inclined to just say, no, we're not going to play that game, for lack of a better term. We're going to sue and we'll go to court and figure it out. And then a judge is put in the position to figure out whether any kind of divestiture or any kind of plan that the merging party wants to propose to offset competitive concerns is good enough. Can you help our listeners understand how that shifts the dynamic? How is it different convincing a judge you won't have an impact, a negative impact on competition, versus an agency at the consent order level?
Right. So that's a very important distinction in all this. So the agencies technically can sue to try to block any deal that they want. I mean, there's really some prosecutorial discretion there in terms of deciding which cases that they want to pursue in court to block and which ones they don't. But ultimately, what's I think a disciplining factor on their decisions at the agencies is they do have to go in front of a federal court judge to get an injunction to block these deals or at least hold them up. And so the judges are still applying, the law and precedent for mergers that has been around for a very long time. And even if the agencies want to try to push the envelope with new theories or, bring weak cases, the judges play an important role in checking those to make sure that they are consistent with the law. And I think it keeps the agencies from overreaching. Now, in the case of consents, what we've seen is that the agencies have become more stringent on the requirements for agreeing or reaching a settlement on these divestiture packages. And so what companies are doing is they're putting together their own remedy package. They're telling the FTC or DOJ to sue them if they're not happy with that package. And then they go to court and they do what's called litigating the fix. And so what you do there is you put together your own remedy package, you sign it, you put it in front of the judge, and the judge says, well, you're divesting this whole business that's supposedly an issue here that's creating competitive problems. You're divesting it to a very strong buyer. Why shouldn't I just accept this? And so companies have been very successful going that route as opposed to trying to get the agencies to settle before going to court. So it's an interesting issue for the agencies because they may have been able to get an even stronger divestiture package or remedy during the investigation phase than they would once it actually reaches court. So, it's a policy decision for them, whether it makes sense to swing for the fences or to take sort of a, double or triple in these cases.
Hey, as a last question on the U.S., at least for me, I'll swing for the fences too. I'm thinking back over 100 years ago or so, there were companies that grew organically, let's say, but became ginormous, right? And then there was trust busting that went on, and the government came in and broke them up. And that happened a couple times subsequently, maybe with some of the telcos, if I remember correctly. But that kind of thing went dark for a long time. And now we do have some extremely large companies, companies that are a massive percentage of their own index, let's say, on the public markets. And I wonder if you see any chance, like irrespective of M&A, right? Just growth. Can these companies run a risk of getting their trust busted?
There's certainly always a risk. Like I talked about, there is some prosecutorial discretion here on which cases that the agencies want to pursue, whether it's a merger case or not. Now, there is this perception and this populist theory, and it's really a bipartisan populist theory, I'd say, is that big is bad. And when companies are very big, that there must be some sort of harm to consumers that comes from that. And I think where the agencies really struggled is showing that that assumption is actually true. So when you do have very large companies, there are, do tend to be very strong efficiencies in terms of being able to generate, lower prices for customers or generating innovations, just using sort of their vast resources that otherwise, some small company just couldn't fund for a long period. And then I think the other thing to keep in mind is that when these small companies do come out of very early stages and grow and innovate, a lot of times they're taking just enormous losses. And the plan is not to operate the company for a long time at enormous losses. The plan is to get bought out. And so if you start to dissuade those types of acquisitions of those companies, I think what you might see happen is that you'll actually get less innovation if there isn't sort of this exit path at the end of the day for these growth stage companies. So it's an interesting issue for sure. And I think again, the biggest issue that the agencies struggle with is showing that this big is bad perception is actually true because there have been a lot of very strong and beneficial benefits that have come from some of these companies becoming large and generating these types of efficiencies.
Expanding the aperture a little bit, Ronnie, to the international arena, we've seen some mergers, big ones, the kind of blockbuster ones we've been talking about, that have gotten rulings from Europe that rhyme and don't quite rhyme with what might happen in the US and what might happen in the UK, which has its own regulator now that we'll talk about. But to what degree can you sort of give our listeners an orientation on whether your success in one international arena, has relevance for your success in another? I know all of these agencies, pride themselves on having autonomy and assessing merits in and of themselves with their own sort of decision-making process. But have you observed anything that tells us that there's some degree of connectivity here, some degree of signal that might be sent from the first to issue an opinion on a given merger, for instance?
Yeah, so I think, none of the agencies want to be seen as being the outlier. I think, on the cases where they are the outlier, it probably has a bigger impact on them if they're coming out on an issue that's just way off from where the other jurisdictions are coming out on the same merger. Now, I think what we've seen so far in the European Union is that they've been fairly consistent in their enforcement over many years. And so really haven't seen a lot of changes there. I mean, they've always been coordinating with the US agencies, so it's not really anything new to see them continuing to do that. Now, one obvious and I think growing area is the CMA in the UK. And so in the past, before Brexit, you used to have a Europe-wide review of these mergers, and now what's happening is you basically have a new regulator who is reviewing these deals in addition, and it does add an additional step for companies. Whereas in the past, you might have only needed to get approval in the US and EU. Now you might need a third regulator to get on board with that. And so, anytime you have three agencies looking at an issue instead of two, there is the possibility that one of them will come out differently from the others. And, I think that's just a natural part of of how these things work. But again, at the end of the day, I don't think any of the agencies wants to be the outlier. And I think they will take into account what the agencies are doing. But again, they don't necessarily need to follow, and they do have their autonomy.
I'm so glad you talked about that a little, because when you think about what just happened with Microsoft Activision, and we don't have to get into the bill of particulars there at all, but I mean, suffice to say, the Brits did reject that merger. But, in the totality of things, the UK is not the biggest market, right? I mean, do they actually have leverage, or do you think you'll start to see, kind of merger acquisition deals where they don't necessarily make the deal dependent on the green light coming from the UK? Because, it seems much more important to me to get the EU, where you have hundreds of millions of citizens compared to a much smaller number in the UK.
Right. So it really depends on the merger agreements and the assets that are being acquired. So in the merger agreements, you typically will have a condition section that lays out that these are the jurisdictions where approval is required to close the transaction. And what you can do in some cases is there may be assets that are severable in, say, the UK that you could simply separate from the deal or divest or take some other action, an antitrust remedy, in order to resolve an issue that might exist in one jurisdiction in order to close in the rest of the world. Now, what may be a challenge in some deals is that if you don't have assets that are specific to a country, then what can happen is it becomes more difficult to close a deal in the rest of the world when you have an issue in a particular country. So, it's really going to be merger by merger in looking at that issue to see, is there a way to carve out this country from the transaction and potentially sever it off in order to close a transaction elsewhere in the world.
Deal by deal. Ronnie Habash, keeping a close eye, of course, on it at Deckert LLP, a law firm specializing in antitrust. And we're fortunate here on Doubletake to have him join us to talk about the state of play in this important, really buzzy area. Increasingly, antitrust concerns rising to the top of the public policy agenda. So, Ronnie, we want to thank you so much for your time today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you. Great speaking with you both.
This is a financial promotion for institutional clients only, issued by Newton Investment Management North America LLC, NIMNA, or the firm. NIMNA is a registered investment advisor with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, and subsidiary of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation, BNY Mellon. The firm was established in 2021, comprised of equity and multi-asset teams from an affiliate, Mellon Investments Corporation. The firm is part of the group of affiliated companies that individually or collectively provide investment advisory services under the brand Newton or Newton Investment Management. Newton currently includes NIMNA and Newton Investment Management Limited, NIM, and Newton Investment Management Japan Limited, NIMJ. Any statements of opinion constitute only current opinions of NIMNA, which are subject to change and which NIMNA does not undertake to update. This publication or any portion thereof may not be copied or distributed without prior written approval from the firm. Statements are correct as of the date of material only. This document may not be used for the purpose of an offer or solicitation in any jurisdiction or in any circumstances in which such offer or solicitation is unlawful or not authorized. The information in this publication is for general information only and is not intended to provide specific investment advice or recommendations for any purchase or sale of any specific security. Some information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources that are believed to be reliable, but the information has not been independently verified by NIMNA. NIMNA makes no representations as to the accuracy or the completeness of such information. No investment strategy or risk management technique can guarantee returns or eliminate risk in any market environment, and past performance is no indication of future performance. ESG analysis refers to a range of internal and external qualitative and quantitative research. Newton manages a variety of strategies. Whether and how ESG considerations are assessed or integrated into Newton strategies depends on the asset classes and/or the particular strategy involved, as well as the research and investment approach of each Newton firm. ESG may not be considered for each individual investment, and where ESG is considered, other attributes of an investment may outweigh ESG considerations when making investment decisions. Analysis of themes may vary depending on the type of security, investment rationale, and investment strategy. Newton will make investment decisions that are not based on themes and may conclude that other attributes of an investment outweigh the thematic structure the security has been assigned to. If distributed in the UK, EMEA, Australia, New Zealand, this podcast is issued by Newton Limited and may be deemed a financial promotion. Newton Limited is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, 12 Endeavour Square, London, E20, 1JN, in the conduct of investment business. Registered in England, number 01371973. NIM is also registered as investment advisors with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, to offer investment advisory services in the United States. If distributed in Canada, this podcast is issued by either Newton Limited, which is availing itself of the International Advisor Exemption, IAE, in the following Canadian provinces: Alberta, British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec. The IAE is in compliance with National Instrument 31-103, registration requirements, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations, or NIMNA, which is availing itself of the IAE in the following Canadian provinces: Alberta, British Columbia, and Manitoba. The IAE is in compliance with the National Instrument 31-103, registration requirements, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations.